This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Asked me again what I've been doing, gave slight amount of information and tell her I'm now in the room.
You're listening to test transmissions for Resonance 107.3 FM.
A music and radio art station
broadcasting until the 5th of July.
As part of John Peel's Meltdown
98.
Broadcast proper start from midnight tonight.
If you'd like a program guide for the station, call LMC on 0171 403 1922.
Shake. Rattle, roll, shake, rattle, roll.
Hey, that's a fire. Hey, what a fire. Whoa, consumed by flames. Woo! Hey, hey, that fire is a little out of control.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. This week's guests are Stephen Cleary, lead curator, literary and creative recordings at the British Library, and Sandra Cross, artist and author, whose extensive recordings of her journal Limbo are now available via the British Library online sound and moving image catalogue. And more of that later, but the British Library has one of the largest sound archives in the world, containing over 1 million discs, 185,000 tapes, and many other sound and video formats, including born digital files. Whatever they might be. Perhaps Stephen can tell me what a born digital file is later. Steve has worked for the British Library Sound Archive since 1994 and was lead curator of the recent free exhibition Listen, 140 Years of Recorded Sound, which ran from October 2017 to May 2018. His department collects and makes accessible documentary recordings of literary readings, drama, live art and other non-musical performance in Britain, together with recordings of ancillary material such as interviews and discussions. So thank you both for coming in, Sandra Cross and Stephen Cleary. Stephen, that opening transmission, that was intriguing, of course, being a very, very early... what do we call it? Piece for resonance, in fact.
Thanks for having me, by the way. Yeah, you could call that a trailer. I brought that in because, since we're here, that sort of predates almost the... in a sense it does predate the actual broadcast history proper of Resonance FM, because this was a trailer... a test transmission that ran on a sort of loop before the beginning of the first set of Resonance FM broadcasts, which were made in June and July 1998 as part of the DJ John Peel's Meltdown Festival on the South Bank. That's where they were transmitting from, pre-digital. I think the broadcast radius was something like 3 miles before it started breaking up. And at that time, the British Library Sound Archive, of which I'm part, was based in Exhibition Road in South Kensington, then part of the British Library, but working under the title the National Sound Archive. So we made an arrangement to record these Resonance FM initial transmissions off-air using an aerial on the roof. But we were sort of on the border of the three-mile broadcast radius, so it breaks up a bit. You would have heard in that example probably that the reception isn't that great. Nobody please ring that phone number, because I forgot that was there, and I don't know what would happen if you try to ring that now, so please don't bother anybody ringing that number.
So you would have been forewarned. You knew in advance that this was going to take place?
It was arranged, yeah. We didn't just record without asking anybody, and... at that time, and even now, to an even greater extent, we did have a dispensation to record BBC radio programmes, BBC programmes. So we did have a setup for doing that at that time, so that we could record while nobody was in the building at weekends and so forth. We recorded digitally onto VHS tape, because you could set the timers on the recording machines. So that's what happened around the end of the 90s. Now it's a much more expansive off-air recording programme, but focused mainly on news broadcasts, actually.
Right. And do you archive all the Resonance broadcasts now? How does that work?
Yeah, I'm not sure when it dates from. I'm not actually directly involved in this myself, but we do have a programme and an arrangement with Resonance to archive all the output. So this programme will eventually be available... perhaps when it's no longer available to listen to online, to listen to visitors to the British Library.
Yeah.
And there are other links as well. For example, there's a programme on Resonance at the moment that's produced as part of the lead up to Neil Bartlett's performance in November, 24 Hours of Peace. And this is something that Neil Bartlett is in the process of putting together or finalising a 24-hour performance in Manchester at the Royal Exchange Theatre on the 10th and 11th of November this year. And it's based on 100 interviews he's made with peace workers. That's the concept. And he'll be making a performance out of this raw material, but the raw material... will come to the raw audio recordings will come to the British Library for archiving after the performance, and we'll also, as is normal working, be recording the live broadcast that will happen on Resonance of the actual event.
Right. So there is a direct interaction between the British Library and Resonance regarding that project. Is it?
Yes.
Right.
Well, okay. Actually, probably via. Neil Bartlett and the producer, actually, but yes, everybody's aware of what's happening. We don't do things without arranging it first.
Okay. And so perhaps you could tell me a little bit about what your actual role is at the British Library, sound recordings, and what are the criteria for your accepting work into the library?
Well, the sound arc of the British Library is divided curatorially into seven or eight small departments of one or two people. So there's one person who deals with popular music, for example, and so on. One person who deals with wildlife sounds. I work with a colleague, Eva Del Rey, to collect drama and literature recordings. These come from a number of different sources. The library has an arrangement with BBC Radio in regards to their archive. So anything that they've kept, we can make available for listening on the premises to the public, to anybody interested. We have a small budget for commercially issued spoken word and theatre items. And we also record our own. We generate our own recordings, live poetry, live theatre, some of it on video, actually. That sort of thing. And the fourth provenance would be private, unpublished recordings, and that's arguably the most interesting part. So somebody may donate their own personal historic archive of audio recordings. In fact, Neil Bartlett did do that actually a few years back with his videotapes of shows. Another collection that might be of interest to your listeners would be the Bob Cobbing archive. So at the British Library, there's Bob Cobbing's manuscripts, but also his audio archive.
So in that case, there would be an overlap between written material and sound material, as it were.
Often there is, So for Bob Cobbing, it's not exactly a one-stop shop, but it's as good as you're going to find. You know, you can consult manuscripts, printed books as well, Writers Forum publications, and listen to performances. So that's the area we're involved with, drama, literature, but also live art, comedy. We sort of interpret our remit quite broadly.
When it comes to sort of archival stuff, is it sort of, you tend to, presumably there's a lot of stuff you don't accept?
We have to balance different factors. One of those will be the amount of staff available to do what needs to be done to make it available for people to listen to, which is not infinite, of course. And we do, although it's very difficult to define this, we do have to bear in mind the likely research interest, although we're actually dealing with two different audiences. We're dealing with contemporary audience expectations, but also the expectations that we don't really know yet of audiences in the future. So it's quite hard to do, and we have to look at things like how much there is. So I think for the Bob Cobbing collection, there might have been something like 300 tapes. Well, he's a very important figure in the area of sound poetry. There wasn't really much thought needed to go into it. We thought, well, we do need to have this.
Take it all.
Yeah. Maybe if it was somebody with a much lower profile that not so many people had heard of and there was a lot of material, we might think, well, if we do this, we might not be able to do something else. So it's quite difficult. We don't get offered so many things out of the blue that it becomes a headache, though.
Oh, I was going to say, are you overwhelmed with material? Or
No, not really. No. I mean, if somebody says I've got recordings of myself reading my poetry live in the pub down the road, do you want it? Then we prefer, it's easier to say yes. Yes, we do. If they say I've got 100 recordings of myself in pubs all over the British Isles reading my poetry, we'll probably say, well, we probably don't need all of them.
Oh, so you might take one then.
I'm not quite sure. I like the way this conversation is going. But, generally, we prefer to say yes.
I see. We should say yeah.
This isn't
don't call us, we'll call you.
This is not an appeal, by the way.
Okay. Do tell me, what is this, perhaps I'm hopelessly out of touch, what is a born digital file?
Well, in the British Library Sound Archive, there's something like 42 or more different analogue formats represented, different types of disc, tape, etc., mini discs, little microcassettes, all sorts of things. But these days, we're as likely to receive collections that are just WAV files or MP3s. So born digital just means there's no physical carrier.
That's right. So it originates as a file. That's the original source of it. Okay.
Although I suppose you could say a CD is kind of born digital as well. It's a digital recording. But when we use that term, we're usually talking about files that you can put on a USB stick or whatever.
Right. Should we play an example of something? You've brought a few examples with you. Mm-hmm. That first one was fascinating. I didn't know you'd got such a thing. Is that must be quite rare, I suppose. I don't know if Resonance themselves would have had that, actually. They might not have had the foresight to record, not knowing that it would actually lead to this.
I haven't asked the question, but it's possible that's the only recording.
Right. And how would you have recorded that at the time? What was it? What was the format? I think you might have said, but I can't remember.
Initially, that would have been recorded via something called a PCM unit, which makes an analog recording digital. Don't ask me to be any more technical than that. Onto VHS videotape, but just it was just an audio single, signal rather.
Right.
Yeah, because they could run for 4 hours.
Yeah.
And I think that program, if you played the whole of it, I think that's about 2 hours worth of test transmissions that we recorded.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, this next one is called Beer Bone Tree. What can you tell us about this? What is this?
This is a crackly old recording from over 100 years ago, 1906, of the actor Herbert Beerbohm Tree.
Mm-hmm.
This is 2 minutes of Shakespeare from Julius Caesar, Antony's Lament over the body of Julius Caesar. I don't know if you want to play it first, and I'll talk about it after.
Sure.
Encourage him to engage in an activity of some sort.
That's not it. That seems to be. We're going to come to that later.
Well, I can carry on talking there.
No, we got it now.
But I am meek and gentle with thee. Thou art the ruins of the noblest man that ever lived in the tide of time. Woe to the hand that shed this costly blood. Over thy wounds now do I prophesy, which like dumb mouths do bear ruby lips, who beg the voice and utterance of my tongue. A curse shall light upon the limbs of men. Domestic fury and fierce civil strife shall cumber all the paths of Italy. Blood and destruction shall be so in use, and dreadful objects so familiar, that mothers shall but smile when they behold their infants quartered with the hands of war, all pity choked with custom of fell deeds, and Caesar's spirit ranging for revenge, with Ate by his side, come hot from hell, shall in these confines, with a monarch's voice, cry havoc, and let slip the dogs of war, that this foul deed shall smell above the earth, with carrion men groaning for burial.
Okay. So that's Herbert Beerbohm Tree. Beerbohm Tree.
Yeah.
Was he related to Max Beerbohm?
Yeah, he was, but I can't remember how.
Okay. And then Iris Tree was a poet, I think.
Oliver Reed was his grandson.
Oh, really? Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh,
gosh. What a lineup. Gosh. But it really shows you how, you know, sociologically, how acting has changed and how the voice and everything, I mean, notwithstanding the recording, but just the delivery, the enunciation, the interpretation of the text. It's utterly fascinating, isn't it?
They had to really try in those days for the voice to register, because it was acoustic recording, no microphones. So even if he wanted to do a more subtle interpretation, that wasn't really on, technically speaking.
Oh, okay. So how would it have been recorded? What was it?
Basically declaiming into a horn.
Right. Well, standing in front of the horn and sort of...
Yeah, that's right.
But what would that be recorded onto then? Onto a disc?
A wax cylinder.
A wax cylinder.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that was pressed. That was issued as a disc by HMV, and it's part of a collection. That was the disc version, but as part of the prehistory of the Sound Archive, I suppose, before the Sound Archive existed, when it opened its doors to the public in 1955, the British Museum had been given copper matrices from which you can press records. And that was basically the only sound archiving that was going on. I think this is around about the 1920s. So eventually this British Museum collection of matrices came to the British Library Sound Archive, and some people sort of date the formation of a national sound archive to when these matrices went to the British Museum.
What is a matrix?
It's the stamper you use to press to make a record.
Okay.
So in theory, we could press a new version, a nice clean version of what you just heard without all the crackles.
Uh-huh, right, okay. So you could literally make a new wax disc.
We could do. Okay. It has been done. There's an early record of the voice of Tolstoy that somebody repressed exactly from the original stampers, sort of limited edition for people who are interested in the history of audio formats, I think, mainly, actually.
So what would be the earliest recording that would be in the archive? How far back does it go?
I don't know. In my area, the earliest literary spoken word recording is the voice of Robert Browning, beginning to read one of his own poems and then sort of forgetting. It's not the greatest. Professionally speaking, it's not the greatest thing in the world, but historically very interesting, of course. And that was made 3 months before he died, and I'm not sure when that was, but from memory, but it might have been 1889, certainly thereabouts anyway.
Right.
And that is very early. Sound recording wasn't invented until 1877, and not really a lot happened in the 10 years since it was invented, so that's very early. And there's also recordings of Alfred Lord Tennyson from around the same time, but I think the Robert Browning one predates those.
Okay, right. All right. Should we play something else from your selection?
Do you want to play some bats?
We could do, yes. Absolutely. Let's have some bats.
Threatening to me, Ben.
I think his bare bone tree is still talking. Okay. Is this very subtle to start with?
It's quiet for the first few seconds.
Oh, yes. So that's described as a common pipistrelle.
Cinnamon.
I'm told, yes. That's a group of
cinnamon,
common pipistrelles.
Sweet wood spice, once traded like gold. When I look for my roots...
It's a bit of a... Sorry about that.
That's all right.
I keep sort of jumping ahead to the next piece for some reason.
We're getting some good juxtapositions.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. There's some random sounds coming
live.
In.
That was astonishing, wasn't
live
it?
Mix.
How many bats do you think there were?
I don't know. I asked our wildlife curator, Cheryl Tipp, to give me some bats as a sort of Halloween special.
Ah.
And she described them as a group of common pipistrelles. That's recorded in 1988. Apparently they're using, what's it called, echolocation to locate and hopefully catch insects.
Gosh.
And you can't normally hear these sounds, but... wildlife recorders use a kind of bat detector, which brings the sounds down into the human hearing range, which they aren't in normally.
Amazing.
So they're too high for us to hear normally.
Right. All right.
Sorry, I beg your pardon. I should highlight the fact that the wildlife section in the British Library Sound Archive is massive. It's the largest one in Europe. And
oh, really?
One of the largest ones in the world, yeah.
Right, right. Okay, well, we've probably got time for one more before we move on, as it were. We've got a choice of something called Senivirotine. Is that Viriatni or something? Cinnamon roots. What is that?
Let's play this. It's some poetry. The poet's name, Seni Senivirotni.
Yeah.
Possibly not pronounced entirely correctly. She's from Leeds, of dual English and Sri Lankan heritage. And this is just an example of something we recorded in our own studio at the British Library. We do make our own recordings, often oral history, in this case poetry, as part of a special project. And this is something that you can hear online. Most of the sound archive materials you can't hear online, but we do have about 80,000 recordings online, and if you like this poem, the full reading by Seni Senivirotni is online. Mm-hmm. We're going to retire the current sounds.bl.uk site soon, maybe in a year's time or something, and replace it with a new enhanced one, because we've got this big project going on called Unlocking Our Sound Heritage, and one of the outputs of that is to make accessible a further 100,000 sound recordings of all different kinds once we've got the rights cleared and the digitisation has happened and so on. And that's funded by the Heritage Lottery Fund. But this is something you can hear now.
Is everything backed up? You know, does everything have to be duplicated and stored elsewhere in case the system doesn't?
Yeah, it does. Once it's permanently archived, it's actually... everything is located in three different places across the UK. So everything that we have in London is mirrored at the National Library of Wales, for example, and also in Yorkshire, Boston Spa. The library has a building there.
Right.
So there's three identical resources. So should a disaster befall London, we hope nothing happens in Wales and Yorkshire at the same time.
Okay.
For our heritage, already a heritage to be safe.
I find you, yellowish brown like my winter skin, native of Sri Lanka, growing wild in the jungles of the Kandy Highlands. 1492, Columbus never finds you. Sailing westwards to the lands of the Arawak Indians, he promises spices and gold, trophies for a Spanish queen, brings her Taino slaves as gifts. But Portugal travels east to an island that falls like a teardrop from the tip of India. Find your soft sweetness, wraps it in hard cash, grows rich on your rarity, founding a spice trade that deals in blood. The Dutch make plantations to tame your wild fragrance that can never sweeten their breath, demand quotas of your bark enforced by death and torture, burn down your August harvest, fabled fuel of the Phoenix fire, to keep up the prices. Dutch East India becomes British East India. Your acres grow in the rain and heat of Sri Lanka, filling the coffers of the British Empire. 1992, I buy your ground aroma in pre-packed jars, fry you with aubergine and coriander, look for my roots, find you, yellowish brown like my winter skin, native of Sri Lanka, growing wild in the jungles of the Kandy Highlands.
So that was the poem you mentioned, Cinnamon Roots, which was recorded at the British Library? Or?
Yeah, we do have, as well as a number of transfer studios where the engineers are all beavering away, we do have one soundproof recording studio, which we use for, as I say, modest sort of spoken word recordings, really, not really music, but poetry and interviews, things like that.
Okay. All right, well, that brings us to our next guest, Sandra Cross. And Sandra's film, on November the 8th, Sandra's film Limbo, overlaid with readings from a journal, will be screened in the Knowledge Centre at the British Library. The admission is free, but a ticket is required. That runs from 7:15 to 8:45 on, November the 8th. Is that a Friday or when do you want
to? Yes, it's a Friday.
Friday. Okay, and perhaps you could describe how, perhaps the two of you could talk about how this connection came about and whether your, how your archive came to be accepted into the British Library.
Mm. Well, it was, I visited the British Library and as did so many people, to see an exhibition called The History of Sound. Mm. And I suddenly wondered whether or not the library would like a recording that I had made, which is called the Ems Bar, and got in touch with Steve and almost got Steve first of all, which is quite unlikely. Normally, you know, you have to go all around the houses before you actually make a connection with somebody.
Could you briefly say what the Ems Bar was?
Oh, yes. Well, it's the... I think you've played it before on the radio, haven't you? On Resonance, on Wavelength, rather. Yeah. Yes, it's buffet car announcements on the London to Leicester and Leicester to London train, recorded over a period of a year when I was doing these visits up and down country quite
and
a
that
lot.
Was, that was heard by Johnny Trunk, in fact.
That's right, yes, that's how Resonance. It first. Yes, and Johnny Trunk, I mean, I had no plans for it. It was part of another project called What Did You Eat Today? Because I'm interested in, you know, eating habits and so on. And so what I was doing, I was tracking. I had been writing observational pieces about what people were writing and then eating, then speculating about what sort of people they were on the basis of the foods. Right. But I set myself some limits. I didn't want to become... The people had to sit near me. I wasn't going to go looking for them. So if they sat close by, I would simply record what they ate and then speculate.
So it's a bit like overheards, but in this case it's sort of overeats.
Yes, like the mass observation. Yes, like the mass observation. Yeah. Yes, a man walks into a bar, he's wearing a bowler hat and so on, meets a woman clandestinely, whatever. Hmm. Yeah, so it was that kind of thing. But I had to give up on that because most people, you know, after a period of time... This period of time is reached quite quickly because most people are eating the same kind of things. So you can't really speculate. Then you're into something else because then you're having to look at other elements of the person.
Yeah, yeah.
And I only wanted to focus on the food because...
Right.
As I say, I'm interested
in...
But in
the case of the Ems Bar, you were literally recording the announcements
of
the buffet.
Yes, well, that then became a sort of... that started out because of the roll call of the elements that were being listed, which seemed to say something to me about who we were and where we were as a society, because the ingredients were boiled right down to, just an endless stream of different kinds of coffees, which, you know, not... probably going to be very nice, not really, but you know, nevertheless you get 20 versions and then you might get some I don't think you'd even get a sandwich, you know, it would always be crisps and biscuits. And
wasn't one of the immortal line was something about a grab bag, wasn't it?
A grab bag, yes. So then that became the secondary layer, was about people had not obviously, I was assuming that people were trained to read from a script. You know, about what was in the buffet car, and the buffet car was in coach F or whenever it was.
Right.
And there were always things wrong with buffet car F, you know, the hot water system had broken. So it became a sort of catalogue of who we are and where we are. It was moving away from the food thing. And then finally for me it came to be about the individual behind the announcement, because it became clear that the people were, although we couldn't see them, they were making a bid for something else. They were sort of acting. They weren't necessarily acting, but they wanted to make more of their job.
Right.
So they wanted to sound interesting and interested.
Right.
And so then it became about that. So it just started.
So Trunk issued this as an LP and a CD.
Yes, he heard it on your...
You're travelling backwards and forwards to Leicester.
That's right, yes.
And making a journal
yes.
Based on your mother.
That's right. Well, it came to be that I started to visit my parents more frequently as my father's health dwindled. And then finally, unfortunately, he died. And so I was visiting, and my mother was left in a state of utter bewilderment. His words don't describe it, really. Anyway, so then I found myself going backwards and forwards on the train, sometimes twice a week, really, because there was only me. I don't have any other siblings, and there was nobody else around her. And I was concerned about, obviously concerned about what was happening to her. Mm. Anyway, for about 6 months, I just carried on doing this, trying to keep her safe, and you know, just looking at. Hoping to help her in, mm-hmm. in a variety of different ways. And then because our relationship, you know, had always been a bit sort of cross-patchy, shall we say, you know, we hit that point. Well, this point had been reached quite quickly because she was very volatile and quite an angry sort of person. So from my own sanity, I started to do what actually I suppose I'd been doing on the train was try and make sense of where we were and what we were doing. And of course, the essential ingredient is that at the same time my father died, she was given this dreadful diagnosis of probable Alzheimer's. And the one thing you hear when you hear that fateful word Alzheimer's is, if you have no experience of it, you just remember the bad stuff, like, you know, the person's going over the edge of a cliff and they're going quickly and they're going now. So I wanted to record how she was and how she was living and if things were changing. And it had always been the nature of our relationship was not really a talking relationship. So it was quite natural for me to write things down. For instance, when I lived with them, I used to write them notes saying, can I go to London at the weekend? Or that kind of thing, you know, because we didn't have an open talking relationship. The words that we used in the house were sort of informational or instructions or to do practical matters. But
were they okay receiving the notes or did they find it a bit strange?
Well, I think they thought I was strange. So it was just part of the whole thing, really. It was just, oh, here's another note, you know. So they just sort of, yeah, I mean, they just went along with it. I mean, I suppose that's fairly common, really. I mean, I was quite shy and retiring anyway, so it was... I mean, there were lots of things involved there, you know, about who you are and how you try and communicate with the person.
Yes. Did you ever leave notes for your parents, Steve?
What a question. definitely haven't prepared an answer for this.
good.
Let's move on.
You shouldn't be put on the spot.
No, it has to be an off-the-cuff comment. We're looking for spontaneity here.
Yeah. Do not disturb. Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
Did you? Okay. That speaks volumes, doesn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Okay. And what about you, William?
I beyond Christmas cards, I don't think I ever wrote to them, no.
No.
Shamefully, I suppose perhaps I should have done. It might have been nice for them to receive something from me, but anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, we won't go there. I'm going to clam up as well.
So then Steve got back very kindly, and I think we started to have a conversation, and he said, have you got anything else? So then I mentioned these limbo recordings. First of all, the journal started out as a written. I mean, it would start with me literally standing in front of my mother when I was with her, writing things down, because I entered this state of terror on her behalf, as it were, because she didn't know that she had Alzheimer's almost, or if she ever had. I almost became the sort of the more neurotic one about this. So I was writing it all down whilst standing in front of her, and she'd be saying, what are you writing? And I'm saying, oh, I'm just writing something down. I don't want to forget something. I'm just making a note. Occasionally I'd say, I'm writing about you, but I don't really think that meant very much to her.
No.
Ultimately, it didn't mean much to her. So it was a way of plotting the progress, really, of her diagnosis, you know, were things changing? How were they changing? Would I now need to change in conjunction with the changes, as it were? You know, what do we need to do now that something else had changed? But in fact, she was so stoical and so feisty that really the changes were... And also the other thing that happens is you go to another place in your head where you don't accept, really, that things are the way they are, because you always think you can find a way around it.
Mm.
You know what I mean? You can't completely accept that the person that you've known all this time... Is literally fading.
Right.
And she wasn't fading for a long time. Not really. It was very slight. But for your own survival and sanity, you play games with it, really. You do. There's no doubt about it. You have to. Because otherwise you can't help the person.
Right.
So anyway, then Steve said, you know, he'd like to hear some of the recordings, heard some of the recordings, and...
Well, you should say a bit more about the... You were going, you were making a journal.
That's right,
you then
yes.
would come back to London.
Yeah.
And... Yeah, but you recorded the journal.
Yes, well, there were several stages. There was what I called the scrawlings when I was with my mother, which then I would write those up when I got back home, and then this started in 2006, and then in about 2015, I suspect I was beginning to have to accept that we were into another phase now. Mm. And basically, I think I was trying to remind myself of how it had been with her in the beginning and what it was that we'd gone through, because she was no longer really using words very much anymore. So I think I was filling a gap for myself. And so I started to record the original writings.
Right.
While she was still alive.
Okay.
But in situations that had meant something, that do mean something to me. And so that would be the journey again, the journey to Leicester.
So did you go back to the first phase of the journal?
Yes, I went right back to the very beginning, the first...
And then you would travel on the train to Leicester?
Yes.
And you would speak into what? Into a phone or something?
Yes, into the phone, yeah.
Into a phone?
Yeah.
Basically reading out the journal that you
something
had made
that had already happened many
several years
earlier.
Before.
Yeah.
So that is the text of the...
Yeah, so that gives it a whole new dimension, which psychologically I'm not sure what that means, but it's,
right.
I can see that there is a huge psychological component there in which, in an attempt to sort of prevent something from leaving you altogether, you are revisiting something which is already gone. So there's a kind of madness there, in a way.
On whose part?
Well, mine. I mean, I don't accept that it is madness. I'm just using it as a loose term for...
Well, it's an artistic choice, isn't it?
It is, but it has an emotional thing to it. It has a very emotional pull from my point of view, which is why I also had to.
But why did you choose to do it on the train? Was it because you wanted the ambience of that?
I wanted the ambience of the train, and I also wanted to. The material itself is quite dry, and it needs to be dry because basically it's about a life which is emptying out, and so the content of the journal it describes. What happens when everything else has gone, in a way? The things that we all take for granted every day that we're not even thinking about become these major things, but they become very dull things as well.
Do feel free to join in, Steve, if you have any questions. But you had this colossal archive, I think. How many hours of...
Well, it comes to 4 days' worth of recordings. It's the written journal is 2,000 pages,
right.
And the recordings themselves... equate to 4 days' worth.
Right. And so this sort of played, well, your criteria, I think, or criterion, is for things that are a bit left of field, that are unusual, they're not straight recordings, and so this somehow appealed to you, this method, I suppose, would have
well,
been.
Well, in the part of the British Library Sound Archive, the collecting principles that I put into practice... It's not so much that. We're just as interested in Shakespeare or Greek tragedy as we are in contemporary live art, for example. But one of the things we're interested in is sound works by artists,
right?
Which probably tend to be kind of left field, I guess, avant-garde, I suppose.
Yeah.
We're interested in Sandra's recordings. There's, I think, close to 800 separate short recordings... that make up the whole piece, and I couldn't think of anything else that's quite like it.
Oh.
And I haven't listened to the whole 4 days.
No. I don't think anyone has, right?
Yet, but I've dipped in and out.
Right.
And we did listen to. We didn't just say, "Oh yeah, great." We did ask to listen to a few examples first, and I think it works very well. The spoken word is. Descriptive in a quite clear and simple way. You don't have to struggle to understand it with the other sounds, the ambience of tannoy announcements sort of echoing in the background and footsteps and the rhythms of the train. And I think the fact that it's made on location, as it were, gives it a kind of immediacy that you would not get that quality just reading it in the way that somebody makes an audio book in a studio, for example.
Right.
As I say, it's unique, I think. I can't think of anything quite like it.
No, I think the process of it must be unique. This extraordinary sort of having made a journal in Leicester or between Leicester and London, and then to travel again between Leicester and London and make the recordings on that journey is quite an unusual process, I think.
I think another part of it was that I did try to do some before I hit on the idea of going back into the spaces that were familiar and relevant to the piece itself, recording my own voice in a room, not a room like as nice or equipped as this, and it just sounded deadly. It sounded utterly deadly. The material itself needs an engine, needs an extra layer, in order to give it that life. That it doesn't. I mean, it has a life. It has a timeline. In fact, you know, it's 3 days, 4 phone calls later. That's the kind of timeline that indicates, you know, the number of times that I'm, you know, visiting my mother or speaking to her or whatever. So that's one galvanising factor. But there's a lot for somebody, if anybody were ever to read this, to read it or hear it without some extra dimension, I felt. Mm. And as I say, I came to realise just how, I should have realised before, you know, actors aren't actors for no good reason. You know, it's a real skill to have the breath, to be able to give something that's those requirements that are written, that are.
So when you were speaking it, did you have it in mind to make it expressive, or are you just sort of uttering
the
word?
Had to retain the matter-of-fact nature of it, and that of course would, you know, I didn't want to imbue it with anything that wasn't there. I didn't want to give it some artificial, and that too would have come about if somebody else had read it. It felt, you know, because somebody else would have attempted to interpret it. So whereas I know how it felt and how it was.
I think mostly you had to record it sort of in the lobby of the train, didn't you? Because it would have been too public in the actual carriage.
Oh, yes, I had to be in the corridor of the train, sometimes standing. But it's a very short journey, and a journey I obviously enjoy.
Yes. So the 4 days' worth, Steve, then, is now in the BL archive?
Yes, it's safely in the BL archive. If you go to the British Library and look at the Sound and Moving Image catalogue. Actually, you don't need to go to the British Library because that's online, the catalogue. You can see, if you just type in Sandra Cross Limbo, you'll find the relevant entries and the call numbers you need. Eventually, this will be able to listen to on a sort of walk-up basis in the reading rooms. At the moment, you'll have to make an appointment because they're doing some sort of technical revamping of the way they deliver sound in the reading room. So that might take like it'll be months rather than years, but at the moment you'll need to ring our listening and viewing service if you'd like to listen to it. Right. And if you want to book 4 days, you'll be able to do that.
Well, that brings us on to the film then, Limbo. Tell us a bit about the film, Sandra. What's that?
Well, the film once again is the journey itself from London to Leicester and back. Over which my voice overlays the film, and I read beginning from the first piece of writing that I did for 1 hour and 9 minutes, which is the length of the journey.
And strangely, as it happens, that's the exact length of the mini DV tape, which is what we sort of shot it on.
Yeah.
So the journey from London to Leicester lasts exactly the. So it's a one take.
Take out of the window, of an open window.
And it's sort of overlaid with the journey coming back in negative, so you get a kind of double exposure.
Yes.
In fact, you're going to Leicester and coming back from Leicester at the same time with this, with extracts from this journal.
Yes. And I think that part of that, you know, that sounds fairly chaotic, and if we heard a piece, maybe a little bit of one of these sounds, that sounds chaotic as well. But I think I like a bit of grit in things, and I like the idea that we have to struggle. I think you know, not always.
Shall we just play a bit now?
Yeah.
Give it a snatch of it. If I hope this works this time.
This is after a lifetime of dedication to cleaning exclusively as a hobby, necessity, etc. To me, it seemed to occupy Em unduly, morning, noon and night. If things weren't right, she would become angry. Now she continues, I don't have the energy anyway. Mantra when talking about Dad always slips into, he was a wonderful husband and father. We had a wonderful life together, travelled the world a bit, had a beautiful daughter. I've had a good life. Giving thanks. Since starting this diary, Em's memory seems to be much the same, sometimes better, sometimes worse. And from this point, unless otherwise, Em's mood seems to be less distressed and angry, and our visits together more pleasurable. Other favourite memories include Granny Cross, having to wear a steel corset as a result of a skating accident. At least two aspects of this memory, I think, may be faulty. The steel of the corset may have been bone, and the nature of the accident. Although Granny used to skate as a girl, I seem to remember the accident.
Well, we're going to try and find another one. We'll play. That's see what this one does.
Prevented Granny from ultimately having to be encased.
That's similar. Talk amongst yourselves for a while. This is a.
5 days later, I think one of the first things Em said to me today was, "I'm losing my mind." Em was looking upset and shaking and very worried that she couldn't remember anything. I suggested she sat down and I made her a drink, and soon she was okay again
so
for a while, although her mood would be shaky off and on until she was finally ready to leave the house.
You can hear an ambient sound.
Today's
here.
Symbols include chimneys, as
I'm
described
afraid
earlier,
I can't hear
cars, shiny, expensive.
Well, I can hear clattering of crockery and so
models.
On.
She gets great pleasure from looking at St. Pancras Station, perhaps. Rammel, her word for rubbish. She always draws attention to any scrap of rubbish on the ground, a sweet wrapper or a crisp bag or larger amounts, as when someone has emptied the contents of a house. It seemed to give her a strange pleasure. Keeping the car, silliest thing I ever did, selling your dad's car. Said this about 3 times. Finally, I say, would you have driven it then? Of course I would.
Oh, you can't hear
I passed my driving
at all.
Test years ago. It's as if Em thinks having a license will do the driving for her. She drove once about 25 years ago, and that was it. After Dad died, my partner and I tried to appeal to Em to keep the car. We offered to buy it, and she wouldn't sell it to us. In the end, she got £800. My dad thought it was worth £2,000. We would have been able to drive Em here, there, and everywhere, to do shopping, have her hair done, go to the surgery, hospital, etc., as well as try to keep in touch with relatives who live somewhere away. But no, she was furiously adamant. This was the height of her grief. Also, even without probable Alzheimer's and the way in which it apparently makes it difficult for people to rationalise, I'm not sure Em has ever rationalised any action. It's always seemed to me that she
all
was...
All right. Well, I could hear it. Clearly.
Good.
It has ambient
right.
sound.
I see.
Of sounds
it's
like St. Pancras.
We couldn't hear it, unfortunately.
Okay.
No.
Well, there's a little glitch there.
Yes.
I'm not quite sure what that problem is. But you could hear the other ones. You could hear yours, couldn't you? We could hear yours of the pipistrelle and so on.
Oh, yes, we heard those.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. Well, we should say, so Limbo, the film is screening at the British Library. Can we say it was commissioned by the British Library? What was the procedure to...
The event was commissioned by the British Library.
Right, fine. Okay. And
yes.
That was, and that's
to mark the acquisition of the collection.
Yes,
it's of recordings
of the 4 days of recordings.
Yeah, that's right.
But it is part of this the season of sound, isn't it? Is that's something that you do from time to time?
Yeah, we have got the third annual season of sound, which is a program of events designed to raise the consciousness of the sound archive, that's one aim, and to give everybody an enjoyable experience, that's another. If you go to the British Library website, you can see what else is on. There's a Delia Derbyshire Day,
okay.
For example, coming up in November. There's a dozen or so events that are all quite interesting. Imminently, this Monday, on the 21st of October, if you're free at lunchtime and in the London St Pancras area, there's a free... listening session that my curatorial colleagues Eva Del Rey and Cheryl Tip have put together on the theme of autumn, various sounds from the archive. As I say, that's free, but you do need to book a place online.
Right.
That's the next thing. And I think rather than me go through everything, just pick up a What's On guide when you're there, or look at the website under events.
All right. So Limbo will be screened on November the 8th. That's a film at the in the Knowledge Centre at the British Library. And that it also is free, but you have to get a ticket. You have to book in advance somehow.
We have to know how many people are coming. Yeah, we don't want 100 people turning up when there's not enough seats or something.
OK, so that's between 7.15 and 8.45. All right, well, perhaps we could play one of your, another one of yours, Steve. What's this one about Lee Black Childers? What is that?
I think it's pronounced Lee Black Childers, but I
Childers, sorry.
I think I heard it said that way.
All right.
Not 100% sure. This is an example of an oral history interview. The library has an oral history department that works with the Oral History Society, and these interviews tend to be very long life story interviews under a theme. Mm. I thought this was quite interesting because... having worked a couple of years ago on the punk rock exhibition that the British Library did, I was familiar with the subject of this interview, or the interviewee, Lee Black Childers, as the manager of Johnny Thunder's Heartbreakers in the punk era.
Right.
I was quite curious to listen to this interview. I haven't listened to all of this. It goes on for about 6 hours. He's had a very interesting life, hung around with Andy Warhol and so forth. And I thought that this segment gives an example of the kind of evocative power of these oral histories, but also, far from punk, it's about San Francisco in the hippie era.
Oh, okay.
So he's done everything and been everywhere.
Right, okay, let's give that a whirl.
...prevented Granny from ultimately having to be... ...during their life.
No, I can't get away from it. I don't know. There we go.
I just had to ask you about San Francisco. But did you... Yeah.
Yeah, well, the car that the family dog gave us ran out of gas, and we had run out of money, in the middle of the Oakland Bay Bridge, the one that just collapsed in the earthquake. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, we had run out of gas just over the halfway point, so the tow truck towed us on into San Francisco. So we walked from there to the house where we had some friends. And that was a completely weird experience, even equally as weird as the first time I was in New York, because it was the period of black power. And the people on the ground floor of this building were complete Black Panthers. Very friendly to us, but militant Huey Newton Black Panthers, which was to a Kentucky boy who had very little experience with black people at all, even during the time I was in New York in those days. The culture didn't mix very much. So I was just terrified of them, although it was my fault, not theirs. They were never threatening to me by any stretch. And then on our floor, which was the next floor up, was the ultimate of what you would imagine a crash pad to be. It had many bedrooms, but just Eddie Wolf slept in a chair, just a normal chair, sitting up every night. And not only was it a chair, but it was one of those old 30s plush chairs that the cat peed on constantly. So if you sat in the chair, you had no choice but to sleep. It knocked you out. Eddie slept sleeping up every night. I was lucky because the girl who had gotten there before me really liked me, so she insisted that I get to share the bed with her. Platonic, but at least I got a bed. People were on the floor everywhere. But it didn't matter. It didn't have a bit of relevance to anything. The only thing that had any relevance was the record player and the records. And we literally took acid 5 times a day every day. We wandered through Golden Gate Park. In some ways, I wish I had been more straight so I could have taken further advantage of what was going on at the time, because a lot was going on and a lot of brilliant people were there. I mean, there's no way to describe it in words what it was like to walk down Haight Street, and just, it was like a Persian market, just hundreds of people all just there to be there. And then you walk through Golden Gate Park and just the slopes and the hills just covered with people, covered with bells and flowing robes and makeup and literally flowers in their hair and everything. It was so astounding to be a part of. You couldn't believe it was really happening. It was like you had walked into a movie. But I did take a lot of acid and everything, and so did everyone.
Well, we've gone straight into Doctor Who there, which was another recording brought in by Steve. But Steve, we've got a few seconds left in which you credit the...
Just to say, before Doctor Who, you heard the interviewer Margot Farnham interviewing Lee Blackchilders for the Hall Carpenter Oral History Collection.
Thank you very much to Steve Cleary and Sandra Cross for coming in.
Thank you.
This programme has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.